Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte clear liners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you could pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Delve into the shadows of the mind with Sleeping Dogs, a gripping murder mystery starring Academy Award winner Russell Crowe. Now available on digital. Crowe portrays an ex-homicide detective unraveling a brutal murder he can't recall. Uncovering secrets from his past, he learns a chilling truth. It's best to let sleeping dogs lie. Visit sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery to watch Sleeping Dogs, now on digital. That's sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery.
The Bob Seska Show.
Bob Seska!
Come on, Robin, to the Batcave. We haven't one moment to lose.
The Bob Seska Show.
From our nation's capital, it is Wednesday, January 5, 2022, and this is the interview edition of the Bob Seska Show on the Sexy Liberal Podcast Network. Hi, I'm Bob.
Hello, Bob.
Hello. Day 351 of the Biden-Harris administration, 307 days until the 22 midterms. I am on Instagram at The Bob Seska. Lots of geek stuff over there at The Bob Seska on Instagram. And I'm on Twitter at BobSeska_go. Happy New Year. How the hell was your break? I hope you made it through the holidays without COVID or without burning bridges with your family members. Okay, we're going to start off the year with the movies. Film critic and political writer Zaki Hassan is here today. I've known Zaki for a few years now, and we always seem to line up on both politics and comic book movies, my two favorite things in the whole world. So we're going to talk about both things today. Zaki is a top critic on Rotten Tomatoes. He's also a professor of communication and media studies. His film reviews have appeared in the San Francisco Chronicle, HuffPost, the Philadelphia Weekly, and in 2015, he was inducted into the prestigious San Francisco Film Critics Circle. He also co-wrote Geek Wisdom. It's a book called Geek Wisdom, The Sacred Teachings of Nerd Culture. You can find Zaki's work at zakiescorner.com and on Twitter at zakiescorner. Link in the description under this episode at bobseska.com. Okay, let's talk movies and politics with the great Zaki Hassan.
The Bob Seska Show.
And when you keep us in the dark.
Good morning.
There he is. Hey, Zaki, how are you?
Thanks for having me.
It was short notice. I apologize for that. I was completely out to lunch during the 2 weeks of the holiday break. So apologize for getting to you.
If ever a time to be out to lunch, it's during holiday break, right?
Yeah, but I thought of you while I was on my break because I've been binging the Netflix Daredevil series, which,
oh, nice.
Yeah, I'm way slow on the uptake with regard to that. But it was after loving the Hawkeye series so much. Why? Maybe you could tell me why the hell did Netflix cancel Daredevil after only 3 seasons? It's actually better than some of the actual Marvel movies.
Well, I think what it came down to was the cancellation occurred just as Disney was ramping up to Disney Plus. And I think Netflix was like, they didn't want to be competing.
Yeah.
With Disney. So the contract that they had was such that it took those Netflix Marvel characters off the board for 2 years. So Disney couldn't do anything with them for a 2 year period. So I think Spider-Man No Way Home and Hawkeye, they coincide almost exactly with when Daredevil was canceled.
So what is it about Marvel that they end up agreeing to some of these deals, like, you know, giving away Spider-Man and the Hulk went to Universal? They seem to be just, at least prior to the MCU developing, they seem to have been just throwing properties all out there. I guess this was a matter of comic books hitting sort of a dark age, kind of in the 90s a little bit there. And so maybe this was a financial move. I don't know. I don't know how else to explain it.
Yeah, well, it's easy to forget because the MCU is such a fact of life now.
Yeah,
that right. The notion of putting all these characters together and just having it be this constantly unfolding thing was not even like far-fetched. It was like, well, that's just never going to happen. You know, that's like 20 years ago, a little over that. And so specifically when it comes to Spider-Man, I mean, there was a rights morass that just tied that character up, webbed him up, if you will, for like the entirety of the 90s.
Yeah.
And so finally, when Sony ended up with it, it was after, you know, cutting through, like Orion had this slice of the rights and MGM had this, and they eventually got it. And then, you know, they signed the Marvel people just like the worst deal of all time.
Yeah. I know.
And also with the X-Men stuff, too, the only difference is that stuff ended up at Fox, which, you know, through corporate. I mean, it's all evil, right? All these mergers, but
yeah, I suppose
the one upside in just this cascade of evil as well, but the MCU gets to use Wolverine, which I guess.
That's part of the agreement. They give us great movies. They give us great TV series, but at the same time, we have to endure the evilness of what happens behind the scenes. It's like seeing Steve Mnuchin's name pop up in the credits for some of the DC movies. Like, oh, shit, now I got to cope with Steve Mnuchin in this movie that I love having some to do with it
in the Lego Batman movie or whatever.
Yeah, I forgot about that. What did his name didn't pop up in the Lego Batman movie, did it? Or are you just saying?
Fairly certain he's in there.
Oh god damn it.
Yeah.
Oh, shit.
Somebody can double check, but I'm like 87% certain he's there.
All right. Well, we're gonna circle back to all of this crap here in just a second. But you know what? I also really wanted to talk to you about a little bit of politics here before we dig into comic book movies again. Tomorrow, of course, is the 1 year anniversary of the 1/6 insurrection. A year later, do you feel as if the pendulum is swinging away from fascism, or are we continuing to move slowly toward it? What's your read on where we're headed at this point and what we're headed toward? Because it depends on the day for me. Some days I feel like, well, things are improving a little bit. I mean, you have to look for it, but, you know, things are getting better. But then other days I go, ah, shit, we're screwed. Where are you on that front?
You know, I'm definitely, it is sort of depending on when you catch me, but there is even in my moments of guarded optimism, there's this foreboding, and it's hard for me to truly encapsulate, but I can't help but feel like we are slowly moving towards something even worse than what we have already been through. And I don't know. I don't know if that's me being alarmist or not alarmist enough.
Mm-hmm.
I just don't know.
You know what? I don't think you can be too alarmist. I think with the urgency of what's happening, the things that we've witnessed, certainly a year ago tomorrow, that these are all valid concerns. I think the level of concern is matching the level of the threat. And I think the danger is more along the lines of not taking it seriously enough. And I tend to think that sometimes when you talk in broader, more conceptual terms like saving democracy or preventing fascism, that I think sometimes people's eyes glaze over and they go, what does that even mean? What, you're talking crazy talk now. That can't happen here. Well, yeah, it kind of is. It's all happening here. Threat to democracy, rise of authoritarian fascism.
I mean, it's all, you know, Sinclair Lewis laid it out like forever ago.
Mm-hmm.
It's the conversation. I was having a conversation with my brother yesterday, and we were talking about in Virginia, you know, the traffic jam and everything that happened there.
Oh yeah.
And it occurred to me, I'm like, Trump was an idiot autocrat.
Mm-hmm.
And one day we're going to get an efficient autocrat the autocrat who says, oh, clear the traffic, you know, like fix that so that people are like, oh, well, hey, he did that. Mm-hmm. You know,
yeah,
he gets the trains to run on time, so to speak. And that's what I'm worried about. More worried about that.
You know, there's a theory that because the greatest generation that witnessed the rise of fascism, certainly in Europe, imperialism in the Pacific and so on, they're all dying off. So therefore, the memory, the institutional memory of those events are kind of wearing away. Like there's not as much awareness of the threat. But it seems to me as if there has been plenty of filmmaking that's been happening that's reminded us of the threat of fascism. It's not like it's some now hidden secret because the greatest generation is in their 90s or even in some cases their hundreds. It seems like this should be fresh in our minds. So sometimes I question that theory that because there are fewer people who experienced it and therefore we're careening more toward it as at the very least a curiosity.
I wonder if people's concept of fascism is sort of wedded to this notion of, well, if we don't see brown shirts marching in the streets, then it's not really happening, right?
Because
to me, I look at, to me, when we have a House of Representatives that allows a Madison Cawthorn or a Marjorie Taylor Greene the whole clown car, I feel like we have lost the threat. Fundamentally, something is broken.
Yeah.
Because I have ideological disagreements with people in the Democratic caucus. There is no one there who is remotely comparable to the people I mentioned.
Yeah, it's confounding sometimes that we live in an age where there are objectively horrible people that are now being elevated to a level, a stature of importance, Donald Trump being one of the best examples of that. Or worst. Yeah, exactly. And I wonder what has led to that. Is it the slow boiling of the frog? Is that the kind of thing, like the Republican Party was always headed in this direction? Or is there something that's more cultural that has risen up over the past, decade, maybe the past 6 years or so, depending on how you measure it, that has brought us to this place where there are millions of people. We're talking about maybe upward of 74 million people are like, yeah, this is fine. This is not a problem. This is completely acceptable here in the United States. Please keep going. And they continue to support it. I can't wrap my head around what's brought us to that extreme.
I say this in my classes all the time and I sound like a grumpy old man, but to me it's social media, social media, social media.
Yeah.
In the new Matrix film, one of the characters as describing the hold of the Matrix on the people who are trapped. And he says, the key is just keep people in this cycle of fear and anger.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's the trick.
Yeah.
And I mean, that's what social media has done. And it's siloed everybody to the point where, there is no longer an objective. There's no baseline where you can be like, well, this is what I feel. Well, this is what I feel. Let's see what the facts say. Well, the facts say this. Okay. I was wrong.
Yeah.
Now there's no concept of that anymore. Mm-hmm. And the scary part is there's no unfrying this egg.
Yeah. There's a bigger issue that I think you can correlate in with not just social media, but with the broader internet. I always wonder if the internet came along too soon, if we just weren't ready as a society to be able to handle the democratization of information. And I
firmly believe that.
Yeah.
I firmly believe that.
Yeah. And I mean, I'm someone who's availed himself of the internet. I mean, my entire career for the past 25 years has been centered around the internet. But at the same time, I recognize some of the dangers of that. And I can't help but to correlate the glut of information that we're hit with on a daily basis with this, what I've been defining as the American nervous breakdown, as this breakdown of how we behave in society, how we interact with other people, how we can no longer seem to act as a community. Is this sort of the thing that you're seeing too? Is it beyond just social media? Is it something where we're just incapable of handling all of this information, whether it's disinformation, misinformation, or actual information?
Oh, I see it constantly. You know, I teach public speaking, and I teach media studies, and specifically, yeah. I focus in on journalism and things. And so I drill down on this hard, you know, this mm-hmm. idea of, you know, just checking your sources and what does that mean? And it's become my cross to bear a little bit, because I'm just like, I've been teaching now for about 18 years, right? It's 16, 17 years. Yeah. And so I've been seeing in real time how social media has impacted how my students take in, process, and repurpose information. I've witnessed it longitudinally. Hmm. And it is gosh darn terrifying. It truly is. The death of expertise. That's what we're living through, right?
Yeah.
Now.
Yes, very well said. I love that. That's Tom Nichols wrote a book with that title, yep. that specific That's title. Right. And I thought that was, yeah. you know, say what you will about Tom's politics and his curmudgeonly attitude online, but still, he nailed it with the central thesis of that book. There is a separation. There is a divorce happening between consumers of information and the experts who actually generate that information.
Yeah, well, you know, what's interesting to me is, and you know this because I on Twitter I engage in the political sphere and also in like the film nerd sphere, yeah. and I see certain dogmatic behaviors that have this weird Venn diagram of overlap, mm-hmm. and it's this sense of like, oh, you're a critic, don't tell me you're one of them their elites, you know yeah. what I mean? And I'm like, man, let me show you my monthly bank account. I'll show you how elite I am, right?
Exactly right. Yep.
You know, and the same thing is applying in an entire different sphere, just what we've seen with the response to the pandemic, mm-hmm. right? And the way, I mean, you know, if I just look at what Anthony Fauci, I see his brow is like perpetually furrowed because he's like, guys, mm-hmm. I didn't ask for this. I want to retire. I want to just like be with my grandkids. I'm just trying to help y'all, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
And it's this, well, who made you the guy? And it's like, well, he went to school. He learned this, right? Yes. That's how it works.
Right, yeah, yeah. And we've seen that illustrated in this new Adam McKay film, Don't Look Up, which seems like this would be something that's kind of squarely in your wheelhouse, both combining satire of exactly where we are as a society right now and this existential threat that's coming down.
Yes. And so I have not seen the film yet, but I know, okay. I know that I'm trying to find the time to watch it. Yeah.
Well, it's one of those things where you're going to look at it and whether you like it or not, I think you have to accept the reality that it's holding a mirror up to all of us, whether we're liberals, Democrats, Republicans, conservatives, etc., that it's, to an extent, it's all of us. We're all contributing to this distraction-oriented meme culture, which is the kind of the central thesis of the film. It's basically that, right. you know, this comet is heading toward Earth, and all we can do is tweet stupid shit about it and make, you know, video memes on TikTok about it. The reaction to the movie was interesting insofar as proving the movie's thesis. And what I mean by that is a lot of people saw it and saw the opening credits and noticed David Sirota's name come up. And he's a sure. divisive character. I mean, he's had me blocked since 2013. Recently unblocked me because I had favorable things to say about Don't Look Up. But there was this focus on, fuck this movie. David Sirota had something to do with it, which in fact proves the point of the movie, which is you're missing the bigger message by focusing on this completely inconsequential credit at the top of the film, when yeah. all he did was just say a log line to Adam McKay in a phone conversation. As like, screw this. I'm not going to look at this because it's David Sirota. Well, yeah. you've just proved the point of the movie. But it's so, and yeah.
What you're saying, what's so interesting to me about what you're saying, right? It gets to sort of, you know, cognitive dissonance, how we react to cognitive dissonance, right? When mm-hmm. what we want conflicts with what is. So you can imagine a film like this is pointing out an uncomfortable reality that people have to process, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And one of the ways we respond to cognitive dissonance is we reject the messenger, mm-hmm. right? So Sirota's name offers an off-ramp. Well, it's that, come on, it's that guy.
Yeah,
I don't want to, you know, and you know, that's very instructive, but it's also affirming a truism about human nature.
Well, and then the other truism that comes up in the movie is basically in the film, it generates the title of the movie, which is that at one point, Leonardo DiCaprio stops his car, sees the comet in the night sky, and says to everyone, because of course there's a movement in the United States to deny the existence of the comet, right? Mm. You can see the allegory coming down Main Street for that. And so what he does, he gets out of his car and points to the comet and said, "Everybody look up. There's the comet. Can you see it? Everybody look up." And he starts telling everybody to look up, everybody on the street corner and so on. And everyone starts to look up. And then that becomes a meme. Look up, just look up becomes a meme. And then, of course, the Fox News contingent, or the fictionalized Fox News in the movie, starts saying, "No, don't look up. You shouldn't look up." And so, you know, you get the political heads butting and it becomes a, you know, whole hot potato there, but just so appropriate and defining also the name of the film in and of itself. And right. I think an important work, irrespective of whether you think it's a great movie. So I'm interested to hear your reaction once you have a chance to see it.
Yeah. I've sort of glided past the sort of overheated discourse because I haven't seen it yet, but I'm a fan of Adam McKay. Mm. I love his essay films. You know, I assign The Big Short in my classes, so I'm very much looking forward to watching it.
How are you coping with the pandemic at this point? I myself have reached the disillusionment with humans stage of coping. are you there yet?
I try to stay optimistic, but it is exhausting. Mm-hmm. I think that the place I'm at now is like all I can do is whatever I can do. I'm not going to rely on sort of the world at large.
Yeah.
I've done triple shot at this point. My family, my daughter who's four, she's the only one who's obviously she's not vaccinated yet. So that I'm trying to be extra cautious. Mm-hmm. But I've been fortunate in that no one in my immediate circle has perished as a result of the illness.
Yeah, that's great.
And I think statistically, that's an abnormality, you know, so mm-hmm. I feel very lucky about that. But definitely now in the last week or so, I mean, gosh, breakthrough infections just up the yin yang. And so my entire extended family is like vaxxed and boosted. So I'm glad about that. You know, I haven't had to have like the angry conversations with close family, which I'm so glad about. Mm-hmm. You know, thank right. goodness for that.
I haven't known anyone, at least directly, who has died from it yet, but something has died inside of me. And I can say that with all honesty and all seriousness. I mean, there was a point where I had this, you know, this level of, you know, as a liberal, I'm pretty patriotic as far as my view of my fellow American. You know, like we've achieved some great things. We went to the moon. We defeated the Nazis. We defeated Imperial Japan. We did all these wonderful things. We created the internet and the iPhone and all the rest. And we just can't do this. And over the past, certainly going back to 2015, 2016, and the rise of Donald Trump, the election of Donald Trump, coming to terms with that, but then that melting into the pandemic by the end. And now here we are coming up on 2 years into this thing with very little end in sight, obviously some rays of hope. But, you know, with that, I go, you know what? I can't find it within me anymore to say, yeah, we can achieve things like defeating right. the climate crisis or whatever the next pandemic happens to be, or this issue or that issue. It's not a great place to be in, Zachy. I don't know if you're in the same place, but man, it's been hard to see all of this transpire and then go, God damn, you know what? A large part of this has very little to do with Donald Trump or Joe Biden or whoever else. A lot of this has to do with our inability to see the macro picture, the societal picture in all of this. And I don't know what can change that.
I think what the last couple of years have shown is that, to your point, like we're not as advanced as we think.
Yeah.
Because we're subject to the same superstitions, the same tribal desire to just cling to our team.
Mm-hmm.
You know, as you said, Trump is certainly a symptom of something much bigger. But on the other hand, when you look at the early days of the pandemic, I mean, this guy, when you think about it, if he would have just been like, look, this is going to be a challenge. We're going to get through it. It's going to be rough. We got to get through it. It's going to be difficult, but we have to ride it out, whatever it takes. Right. Mm-hmm. Nobody would have blamed him.
Yeah.
Like people would have, even people on the left would have been like, yeah, he's saying something that makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
And his own paranoid, you know, the whole, you know, oh, I can't be seen as weak or the economy, well, all the nonsense. Like he turned this into that much more of a challenge, because when you think about it, before this pandemic, the anti-vaxxers were these fringe hippie characters.
Yeah.
It wasn't a measure of what your political affiliation is.
Mm-hmm.
And now it's an article of faith that A, Trump won the election, but it was stolen, and B, the pandemic is made up and vaccines aren't real. And even when he says, no, actually it's real. I mean, you know, they turn on him, you know?
Yeah. Yeah.
That's where we're at.
All right. More with Zaki Hassan here in just a second. But first, today's show is sponsored by BetterHelp. If there's something interfering with your happiness, if there's something bringing you down, if there's something depressing you, preventing you from achieving your goals, don't sweat it. I've got the solution for you. Write this down. It's called BetterHelp. It's not a crisis line. It's not self-help. It's professional therapy done securely online. BetterHelp is going to match you with your own licensed professional therapist in under 48 hours. You can log into your account anytime you want, send a message to your therapist, and get a timely and thoughtful response. Plus, you can schedule weekly video or phone sessions so you won't ever have to sit in an uncomfortable waiting room, possibly getting Omicron. None of that crap. BetterHelp is committed to facilitating great therapeutic matches, so they make it easy and free to change therapists if needed. It's more affordable than traditional offline therapy, and good news, financial aid is available. BetterHelp wants you to start living a happier life today. So here's the deal. Visit BetterHelp.com/Seska. That's BetterHelp.com/CESCA. And join the over 2 million people who've taken charge of their mental health with the help of an experienced professional. In fact, so many people have been using BetterHelp that they're recruiting additional therapists in all 50 states. Here's your special offer for Bob Seska Show listeners. Get 10% off your first month at BetterHelp.com/Seska. That's BetterHelp.com/Seska. Thank you.
The Bob Seska Show.
It's hard to have hope when you're looking at things and going, yeah, you know what? Fuck it. It's Chinatown. It's not going to change. You know what I mean? It's just like there's something. I feel a sense of futility sometimes when I'm talking about this stuff, because I'm debating between the idealistic side of myself and the more disillusioned, cynical, realist side of myself. Mm-hmm. And so I'm in this constant garbage compactor trying to figure out, you know, a way out. And that's a real challenge. And it's not helping to have, you know, segments of the press. And I try not to indict all the press, because there is some great reporting happening. Certainly during the Trump years, we had significantly excellent reporting going on. But I see the current condition of journalism and I go, wow, you know what? Ultimately, those of us who are, you know, spending our days on Twitter and writing about this stuff independently, we're like the last line of defense, really. I mean, we're kind of on our own, aren't we?
Yeah, it does feel like it.
But along the lines of the pandemic, and this is kind of semi-related, certainly, you know, in the list of priorities, not way up there. But let's talk about the move toward streaming over theatrical presentation for films. Are you at the point now where you're grieving the death of theaters, or was it always going to happen and the pandemic simply accelerated that?
Yeah, I think, you know, what I've said previously is that even before the pandemic, we were seeing a great sorting.
Yeah.
Where the theatrical experience is clearly not dead, because a whole mess of people went to see Spider-Man.
Oh, yeah.
You know, at pre-pandemic levels. So clearly there is a desire, but what we are seeing is that desire is pretty much boiling down to you know, maybe superhero movies and not even all superhero movies. I mean, that Marvel stamp in front is obviously a big factor, but kind of the big, the franchise and the crowd pleasing, you know, the theme park rides. And I don't say that even dismissively because I get the appeal of that. Definitely, like, Don't Look Up would have been a theatrical movie.
Yeah.
Not that long. I mean, geez, you know, Vice went to theaters. So now I think people are feeling like the convenience plus the shrinking of the theatrical window has sort of, you know, if we think of like Don't Look Up as like the middle class of movies, the middle class is shrinking just like in real life. Because, you know, the window that what's the theatrical window? It's like 45 days now.
Yeah, just about.
You know, so I think older moviegoers, which includes, you know, people like us, are oftentimes making the decision like, well, it's like a month and a half. I can wait. And so when we're on the other side of the pandemic, which will hopefully be sooner than later, I think a lot of those habits will stick around. I think that's my guess.
Who's leading this switchover? Is it the studios? Is it consumers? In the chicken and egg scenario, is it the studios or is it moviegoers?
It's funny that you say chicken and egg because I was actually going to make that point that it's almost it's hard to say because I think the audience for these smaller movies has been shrinking.
Yeah.
And as it shrank theatrically, these movies have become much more prominent and prevalent via streaming sources. I mean, Netflix kind of for a while there was like the perceived as the dumping ground for like not great originals, you know, not good enough for theatrical, right? That was sort of the perception. And that's not really the case anymore. I mean, they have some, you know, they drop some steamers every now and then, but now there is like The Irishman I'm drawing a total blank.
But yeah, well, I mean, Don't Look Up, as you were saying before.
Don't Look Up. Roma, that's another one.
Roma, you know, yeah.
Like these like prestige films, right?
Yep.
And so now people are getting acclimated to the idea that that's where you can watch them. Now, the trade-off for me personally is there is something about the theatrical experience that is hard to replicate, which is the feeling of like, generally speaking, if you're there, you will watch the whole thing, right?
Yeah.
People rarely will be moved to walk out of a movie outright. Not to say they don't, but you mean it has like your bar has to be much higher of like, this sucks, I'm out of here. Right? Whereas if you're watching on Netflix or whatever, if it doesn't grab you, you flick away very easily.
Yeah.
And so that's something that I feel like once that's lost, we're really losing something, which is not even necessarily the experience with the audience, although there is that, but just the experience, the communion between you and the film in a darkened room where you are there and you're going to watch the whole thing.
Yeah. Yeah. You're a captive audience. And there's another layer that I don't know if we often think about, and that is, there's another layer of fun that's added to the process of seeing a film in a theater, and that is hearing the audience reaction. There's something that's affirming about that. When you personally find a joke to be funny or a scene to be particularly scary or shocking, and then to also hear everyone else reacting the same way, you feel like there's a sense of community around that. And in an age when community is now separated into little branding fiefdoms on social media, it's nice to come together with people who also live in your neighborhood or your town and see something all at the same time where everyone's mixed in together. I mean, pandemic threat aside, there's something that's appealing about that psychologically. And I think we miss that. As much as I love watching a movie in my living room, I miss that. I miss that part of the process, part of the fun of seeing a movie in a theater.
100%.
Totally. Yeah, yeah. And, you know, as we've been saying, comic book movies are driving box office numbers, keeping theaters alive to a certain extent. But the films themselves, despite that, despite the success of the Marvel Cinematic Universe, which is a in the history of filmmaking, it's one of the most colossal achievements that I think we've seen, certainly in our lifetime, if not going back, you know, whatever it is, 150 years. But the films themselves are still punchlines among non-fans. What is it about comic book movies that brings out so much elitist disdain for them? I mean,
these aren't kids movies. I mean, most of the, certainly the Marvel movies and even the DC movies as well, even going back to the Tim Burton universe and then the Christopher Nolan universe, they're allegories for very serious real world problems. And whether it's geopolitical, as we saw with Civil War, or just personal issues like the Spider-Man movies tend to cover a lot. What is it about these movies that draw so much like, those comic book movies are just for kids and they're stupid. And why do so many people love the Marvel universe? There's this whole backlash, right? What's causing that? What really is causing that?
Well, I think there's a couple different sources of sort of the incoming fire, right? One, there's the tribal stuff, which is just as ideological in comic book movies as in actual politics, where fans of one universe are like, well, I like my my colored tights people better than those colored tights people, you know. There's that. And then there's the Martin Scorsese critique, which is, you know, this is the death of cinema or whatever. And I think when you achieve this high level of success, I mean, it does create that resentment of, you know, it's thinning the pool of success available to other people.
Yeah.
Other films. And I don't think that's necessarily true, because I mean, what we've seen with, I mean, just again, just look at the pandemic, look at the films that have succeeded and that haven't. I mean, people have made an effort to go see certain things, and certain ones they've just chosen not to. And going back to what I was saying earlier, I think the Marvel Studios name in front of a film has come to represent a certain baseline of quality.
Yeah.
Which is why, I mean, for all of the sort of, I mean, throughout my life, and I'm sure you can relate to this, you know, superhero films were always the look down on thing, but there's a level of mainstream acceptance of the Marvel universe that's unlike anything I've ever seen when it comes to this stuff. And certainly, you know, I see it with my students who, you know, when you think about it, like now my current age range of students are between 18 and 20. Mm-hmm. So like the MCU has just been around most of their lives.
Yeah.
Like, it's just a fact of their existence. And so that's something I find really fascinating, the way it transcends demographics. And I think that speaks to why those projects tend to be as successful as they are. I mean, I think, like, even Eternals, which was not particularly well received, like, it did okay. I don't think it was like a smash, but it did okay because people showed up.
Yeah, yeah.
Just because of the name, you know? And so it's... To me, I find it exhilarating, but I'm also, because there's that pessimistic side of me, I'm like, well, there's probably like a waterfall just across the edge. We're about due.
Well, you know, I don't peg these things any differently than, say, for example, the lavish Hollywood musicals of the 1950s or the spaghetti westerns that rose up in the 60s and early 70s. These are genres that dominated filmmaking for significant periods of time, and we're just, it seems to me as if we're just in a phase where there are a lot of superhero movies because that's what the audience is demanding. And certainly we're both part of that audience. And so when I hear Scorsese, who I love, commenting about the decline of, you know, modern filmmaking, modern cinema because of these movies, I kind of bristle at that because it fails to acknowledge the history of trends in popular filmmaking over the years. And there's been a lot of, you know, watered down dreck that's hit the theaters at various periods of time in our past. And it had nothing to do with whether it was, you know, a superhero from a comic book as the lead. It certainly had to do with an appetite. It certainly had to do with a zeitgeist thing where, this is an appropriate thing to show at this period of time. The gritty, more auteur-driven movies of the 70s is another example of that.
Well, and not just that. I mean, if we look at the start of sort of what we, you know, the modern superhero paradigm as Tim Burton's Batman.
Yeah.
We're now 30 plus years into this. There is enough diversity within the genre that it's too easy to be like, oh, well, you've got Arrested Development if you watch these movies. Like, come on, you know, like, I mean, 30 plus years out, there are plenty of failures within there, but there are plenty of major, major successes. So mm-hmm. you're diminishing a big chunk of the audience by boiling it down that way. And the other thing, you know, going back to what you're saying about Scorsese, you know, I've said all along, look, man, he made Taxi Driver, he made Goodfellas. He can have whatever opinion he wants.
Yeah.
I may not disagree, but I want to hear what he has to say.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, the Irishman, look, let's be real. He would not have been able to make that the way he did for a theatrical release. It would have been chopped down. It would have mm-hmm. been, he would have had to make compromises. Netflix let him make the movie he wanted, and like it or leave it, that's what he wanted to make.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's one of the exciting things about this is that we're seeing not just auteur driven films appearing in streaming format, but what mm-hmm. we're also seeing, and this is one of the great advantages, this is one of the things I love about it, where you take, for example, a miniseries like Dope Sick or Promising yeah. Young Woman or The Queen's Gambit, where it's just, it's one season, maybe six episodes of something. But if you think of it in terms of the theatrical paradigm, basically what we're getting is a three movie trilogy broken into six parts. That story arc is something that would normally take, several years to tell in theatrical presentation, and we're getting it all in one big chunk. To me, that indicates a significant upswing in the kinds and quality of films that we're getting now. And that's only, to me, a positive thing, irrespective of whether it's superheroes or gangsters or, a fantasy story or whatever. So it seems to me it's all good. And to complain about streaming, yeah, it's great to see something in a movie theater, but at the same time, the quality of the filmmaking that we're getting is benefiting from that platform.
Yeah. And that's, you know, part of me wonders if it's just I'm sort of wedded to that specific, you know, my reverence for the theatrical experience. Sort of, I'll always sort of cling to that. Mm-hmm. But I have to fully acknowledge that, you know, kids today, and I realize me saying kids today just makes me sound like 20 years older than I am. I mean, they're watching this shit like however, you know what I mean? They'll be sitting in their car mm-hmm. watching Breaking Bad on their phone. You know what I mean? So yeah. So the barriers are breaking down, and I don't know that that's necessarily a bad thing. I mean, it's just what it is.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. If I were a filmmaker, though, I would bristle at people watching my movie on their phone. Sure. That would be the one thing. I mean, I watch all this streaming shit, but it's always in my living room on my big television from Costco. So that is, to me, the most faithful way to view streaming content. And yeah, that goes back to Scorsese. I guess he was complaining about people watching his movies on a telephone. And you know what? Yeah. He's got a point. He's got a point in that.
And the thing is, you look at that and you're just like, I fully agree with that, and I certainly wouldn't do it, but that's what's happening. And for many people in the audience, that's just how they're consuming it.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so how do you swim against that tide?
Mm-hmm.
Somebody tweeted something a while ago, which I found very funny, where this was when the movie Tenet was about to come out.
Yeah.
And, you know, Chris Nolan was like real hell bent, you know, you got to watch it in theaters, got to be theatrical. And somebody said, and I'm paraphrasing, but they're like, I want to record a video of Christopher Nolan watching me watch Tenet on my Apple Watch. Watching Tenet on my Apple Watch, and I want to screen the video of Nolan's reaction in IMAX.
I love that. Oh my God. Yeah, yeah. That is great. And you know, that brings up an interesting point just from a fanboy perspective. And I know in the last few days, at the very least, and I know this has happened to you before.
I know where you're heading.
Where, yeah, you've been up against some of these fanboy collectives, whether it's Star Wars fanboys or Zack Snyder fanboys. I mean, I'm in this weird phantom zone, Zachy, where I love Zack Snyder's DC movies, all three of them.
Right.
I mean, I'm like the only fan of Batman v Superman, Dawn of Justice, the Ultimate Edition, of course. But I also love Star Wars. Yet so many of the fanboys in these two areas are completely toxic and like off the charts militant. I've noticed that you face the wrath of both Star Wars fanboys and Zack Snyder fanboys. What is that like going up against? See, I deliberately avoid it because I deal enough with that kind of crap with politics. I don't need more of it. And you're kind of in both worlds. So how do you deal with that?
You know, the Snyder stuff I find endlessly fascinating because I, like, you talk about like being in a bubble. That's what I get from these really militant Snyder fans, you know, and I should couch this by saying I adored Zack Snyder's Justice League, the 4 hour. Yeah. It's one of my favorite movies of last year. I think it's one of the best DC movies ever made.
Absolutely.
I loved it. I just watched it 2 days ago on the 4K Blu-ray that I forked over for. So I'm not, you know what I mean? Like I've spent money to own this.
But why do you hate Zack Snyder?
That's the conversation again and again.
Yeah.
And it's because, you know, what's funny is I gave a positive review to Watchmen. I gave a positive review to Man of Steel. I wasn't a huge fan of the BVS theatrical cut. And so as a result of that, 5 years ago, six years ago now, I'm still taking incoming fire.
Mm-hmm.
And I find it, you know, I mean, mostly I mute these people. So like they can just be screaming into the wind, you know,
yeah.
But it's literally like they've got these screen grabs of things I said offhandedly, you know, like I said, 6 years ago. And they're just like, yeah, well, you said this, you know, and I'm sort of I'm like, look, I changed my mind. Like, isn't that a good thing?
Yeah,
like,
you're an intellectual. That's what intellectuals do. Change your mind with the new information.
Because I in the lead up to Snyder's Justice League, I watched Man of Steel again. Mm. I watched the Ultimate Edition of BVS, and I was like, you know what? As a trilogy, I'm down. I enjoyed it.
Yeah.
I watched it with my kids. They enjoyed it. And I'm like, that's, you know, and I've said all along, hey, if there's more, I'll watch it. If not, well, you know, I've got other movies I can watch, too. I'm going to get on with my life.
Yeah, it's a healthy point of view for a grown-up to have. Exactly.
I'd like to think, you know. And so the sort of militancy... What I find, again, just as like a sociological phenomenon, I'm just like, you know, because they've got their hashtags and, you know, it's like boycott Warner Brothers and all, et cetera, et cetera. Mm. And I'm like, do you think this is going to work? Like, what's your end game here? Right.
Yeah.
Like that ultimately anything, any decision we make, right? We're like, well, what do I want to accomplish? How do I get there?
Mm-hmm.
So if you're sending, you know, cruel messages and death threats, et cetera, well, people in a position to make a decision are not necessarily going to lean in your direction. So why do that? That seems odd to me.
Yeah. Yeah.
Just as a matter of course.
How much of the fanboy community is jacked up by overseas troll farms? I mean, not unlike what's happening in politics over the past 6 years or so. I imagine that the effort to destabilize the United States also involves injecting disinformation into some of these fanboy communities, discussion forums, and certainly Reddit threads and so on. Is that something that you see as going on, or is that simply restricted to politics?
You know, I don't rule it out.
Yeah.
Because some of it really does feel like it almost feels like a parody, right? It feels like,
right.
Like you can't really be like this. You know?
I know.
But yeah. I mean, certainly in the Star Wars Twitter community.
Yeah.
You know, I've said it. I wrote an article for the Chronicle a couple of years ago. This is in the lead up to Rise of Skywalker. And I said, it's an ancient Arabic proverb that no one hates Star Wars more than Star Wars fans.
That's exactly right. Absolutely. That's one that I don't get that at all. I don't know. There's this thing. I guess we love to hate certain things, or that, you know, maybe the original trilogy was out so long as the only Star Wars that we got into this mode where, we love it so much that we feel comfortable picking it apart. And that manifested into or grew into this larger thing where, fuck all of this. And that guy's, we can't have a black stormtrooper and we can't have a woman lead of this new. It's just like, we're talking about Star Wars here. Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. Really frustrating.
I mean, all like for me, when I look at something like Star Wars, I'm like, this is something that in the past has brought me joy.
Mm-hmm.
And so whenever I get to revisit that world, I feel a little piece of that joy again.
Yeah, yeah.
It hasn't happened yet because I've generally enjoyed most of the Disney Star Wars stuff to one degree or another.
Mm-hmm.
But if I reach a point where I'm like, well, I don't like this, I'll just be like, well, I'm not going to watch this.
Right.
Simple, you know, and I expect the same thing will happen with the Marvel things. I'm sure at some point there'll be a thing where I'm like, well, this just isn't, it's just not for me.
Mm-hmm.
And I'll just watch the other thing that I like better. Then that's it.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. Well, on the other hand, when Palpatine rises from the dead, Palpatine has returned.
Somehow Palpatine has returned.
Why is Disney kicking me in the balls? Why is this happening? That's the reaction to it. Palpatine has returned. Oh my God. Disney is raping my childhood. God. You could go all the way back to 1999 and see the same goddamn thing happening around the Phantom Menace, you know. Although it took a couple more years for that to start, but yeah.
Well, no, I mean, and that's actually a really good example because that's the journey I went on with the prequels, because mm-hmm. I would say I spent, you know, a decent chunk of my early to mid 20s sort of being pissed off about the prequels.
Yeah, yeah.
And honestly, it took, I softened over time with them because, as you get older, you just stop caring about most things. It really took watching them with my kids and seeing them react to it, where they just sort of take it as it is.
Yeah.
And that doesn't, you know, as a critic, that sounds counterintuitive. Like, oh, you're going easy on it. It's like, well, no, because I'm not reviewing it. I'm just watching it now. Mm-hmm. You know, like, I don't need to be like, oh, they should have done this. Why didn't they do that? Like all the built up expectations I had.
Yeah. Yeah.
My kids just watch them as well. No, that's Anakin and he's a kid and he's Darth Vader now. And they just take it at that level. And I'm like, you know, my Star Wars will always be those three movies. And I love them for that. And I'll always have that special connection. The other stuff, I'm not going to connect in the same way, but if other people are, and it's bringing them joy, then all I can do is just step out of the way and let them have their thing.
Absolutely. And in fact, I famously did a fan edit of Attack of the Clones because one of those things where when I saw it, I was like, oh my God, well, maybe there's a really good Star Wars movie in here. It's just lost somewhere in this convoluted plot. So I thought, okay, I'm going to see if I can rejigger this thing. So I dumped the DVD into my edit bay and started screwing around with it. And all that being said, I'm not going to sit here and proselytize over all of the downsides of Attack of the Clones. It doesn't seem important enough for that. And certainly there are people who like that movie. I knew a guy who was my same age who was saying, oh yeah, Attack of the Clones, it's like Godfather 2. I don't know what's happening, but something fascinating is going on with this storytelling. You're like, oh, well, okay. All right.
Yeah. What else can you say?
Yeah.
What else can you say about that? Okay.
Yeah. That's fine. Exactly right. Well, you know, I've been wanting to talk with you about anti-heroes and humanizing villains.
Ooh, nice.
What I mean by that specifically is, you know, whether it's Anakin Skywalker being humanized or Darth Vader being humanized as Anakin Skywalker, or Boba Fett now in the new Boba Fett series. We kind of sympathize with Boba Fett. Tony Soprano was kind of one of the earlier, you know, David Chase was one of the early adopters of this. Anti-heroes are humans too. Anti-heroes are people too. And then even this past summer with the Loki series, where this vile, awful villain in the Marvel Cinematic Universe is suddenly you're rooting for Loki, like, yay, Loki. Has the cinematic trend toward bad guys with hearts, how do I put this, blurred our perception of good versus evil, right versus wrong? Has this had any sort of influence in how we perceive some of these more macro moral or value-oriented things?
That is so interesting. Wow. On the one hand, this is not a recent thing. I mean, you can go as far back as Michael Corleone.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
And certainly, I mean, I think for me, what's interesting is the process we as audiences go through as we watch these characters and we end up, you know, rooting for them, if only because we're spending the most time with them in the context of the film. And like, what's the line after which you're like, oh, no, I'm not with you past this, you know?
Yeah.
Right. And I think, like, for example, going back to Godfather, I would say,
you're sort of with Michael up until Fredo dies. And then you're like, no. And I think there's similar examples. You know, I think Breaking Bad is another example.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like when do we jump off the train with Walter White? Or do we?
Yeah, that's the thing. Vince Gilligan is a great storyteller when it comes to the slow boiling of the frog, where Walter White, through the series of awful decisions, goes from someone who, you know, we don't necessarily admire, but we don't hate him either. He's not a bad guy finally he's this horrible drug kingpin. And before we know it, there he is. It's happened. And it's a genius way of telling a character study, telling a story. But at the same time, it happens almost imperceptibly over the course of the five seasons.
Yeah. See, I would say using Loki, like that's almost the inverse of that. Not to say that the shows are comparable, because Breaking Bad is like the greatest thing ever. But Loki is like a bad guy who's slowly on the road to redemption, whereas it's the exact opposite on Breaking Bad. So I think with Loki, I think what we saw there was the acknowledgement that this character, almost despite himself, and I chalk it up to Hiddleston just being so goddamn charming.
Oh yeah,
the audience embraced him, even as he like tried to, you know, he basically in the first Avengers he's trying to be the new Hitler, you know.
Oh yeah, absolutely. Yeah,
you have the Jewish guy being like, no, I've seen you before, you know.
And you know, I'm not necessarily blaming these characters or the filmmakers who invented them for this kind of disintegration, this inability for 74 million Americans, for example, seeing Donald Trump as this virtuous guy who we should elect as president, give control over the nuclear codes to this unequivocal, inarguably bad man, this con artist. And so many people failed to see that despite everyone's warnings, like flagging everyone off. No, this guy, you don't want to elect this guy. This guy's got a long history going back to the 70s of being a colossal prick in New York City. Don't vote for him. And they're like, well, yeah, what's wrong with him? And I'm not necessarily blaming these films or these characters for Donald Trump or anything like that. What I'm saying is, it's possible that our perception has skewed because of this, and then it has been therefore exploited by people like Donald Trump, people like Roger Ailes.
I think you're onto something. Yeah. No, I think you're absolutely onto something. And the only, what I find confusing is there's definitely those people who are like, well, he's an asshole, but he's our asshole.
Yeah, right.
But then there's the people who paint like portraits of him, like all muscle bound and all this kind of weird, like Fabio book cover type things with him, you know? And that's what I don't understand, because I can kind of like, I don't agree with it, but I can understand that, well, we just need an asshole to get in there and just screw things up.
Yeah. Right.
Fine. But where people are propping him up as this sort of, I mean, there's those paintings where like Jesus is looking over his shoulder as he's like signing a bill. Like, where is that coming from?
Yeah.
That's what I don't get.
I know. Well, you know, when I really examine this phenomenon and really start thinking about it, if I were to blame anything, and I'm not, as I said, I'm not blaming the Loki TV series for Donald Trump. It would be ridiculous. But the one thing that I have noticed that has occurred certainly since the late 80s or early 90s is the rise of reality television, where the characters that we love the most in reality television are always the assholes.
Yeah,
the assholes are always the most popular, you know, so members. True. I don't want to say characters. I guess they are characters in a sense. But maybe that looped into the mix as well, knowing the popularity of these shows and the popularity of these despicable, horrible human beings that occupy The Real Housewives. And, you know, you can go back to some, you know, Puck on The Real World, going that far back. Puck is like, anyone, you ask anyone about The Real World, you remember The Real World? Oh yes, I remember Puck. Well, Puck was the dick from The Real World. No one liked Puck, but that's the one we remember. I don't know.
Yeah,
don't
know. Well, you know, you like remember the first season of Survivor, the Richard Hatch. Totally. Exactly, like, right. You know what's funny? I never watched Survivor, but I knew, like, everybody was talking about
it. Yep, yep.
And I'm, that guy, he's the dick. You know?
Exactly.
Literally. Richard was the dick.
And leading up to the election of Donald Trump, he was the host of the Celebrity Apprentice for 12 years. Him and his ridiculous children were on television every week for that span of time. And they were assholes. They were assholes to their contestants. Their contestants were assholes to them. The celebrities who would appear on there, whether it's Gary Busey or Meatloaf, they were all assholes. And we love it. We love it. And so
for a decade or however long they were doing that, they were presenting this fiction of being competent, of being successful. You know, honestly, if anyone needs a smack upside the head, it's Mark Burnett, because as far as he owns at least like 30% of Trump getting elected, you know?
Yeah, yeah. I always hesitate to blame art. I always hesitate to blame the culture for some of these political problems. But I can't help but to see, at the very least, some sort of correlation between assholes on reality shows or the humanization of villains in certain genres of film and, you know, the rise of popular villains in politics, popular villains in public life. And it's hard to square those things. As an artist myself, it's hard for me to blame art for where we are. So it's a struggle.
But you're onto something, because when we see these various congressional critters who are on Twitter and they're kind of talking smack about each other, I mean, how is that different from like the trash talk before a wrestling match?
That's right. Yeah
It's the same. And the fundamental problem is, guys, this is not a wrestling match. Y'all got to get in there and you got to get stuff done. Like, if we're at the point where you know, what's her name is calling people termites and this and that, like, how do you get stuff done?
I know.
We've just as a society, we've lost sight of that. When you're on the highway, sometimes you got to slow down, sometimes you got to speed up so that other people can merge.
Yeah, yeah. Well, unfortunately, we're in this age where trolling is the thing that they're getting done. That's Marjorie Taylor Greene. That's her entire job. It's not,
she's
doesn't
chasing sit, that clout.
Exactly. Doesn't sit on any committees, maybe throws in a vote, a floor vote once in a while. But mainly what she does is she trolls Democrats. That's her entire job as a member of Congress. And I hope people of Georgia will note that when she's up for re-election next year or this year. We're already in 22. What am I?
We thinking? Are.
Yeah, yeah. So speaking of that,
is now.
Are there any movies you're looking forward to this year? Anything coming up that you're really excited for?
Oh, man. Well, obviously the Batman.
Yeah.
Oh, my goodness. Yeah. What's funny is, if you would have asked me a year and a half ago, I'd have been like, yeah, you know, I'll watch it. You know, like, I'm like kind of Batmaned out.
Yeah, right? I know what you mean. Yeah.
And then I saw the first full trailer and I'm like, nope, plug this into my veins. I'm ready.
Mm-hmm.
So definitely ready for that. Honestly, Doctor Strange is one that I think that there's going to be a lot of renewed interest because of, you know, his role in Spider-Man. But I think the first Doctor Strange is one of the best MCU movies. I absolutely love it. So I'm really excited for him to get his sequel.
In fact, I think we're going to get some good visual effects in the new Doctor Strange movie. Because
Sam Raimi.
Yeah. Well, it's also Yannick Serres, who he won the Oscar for The Matrix, the visual effects. Nice. He was a visual effects supervisor on The Matrix. He was nominated for The Avengers, did visual effects on that, did visual effects on Homecoming, Spider-Man Homecoming. I mean, he's worked in the MCU a bunch of times. He did Batman Begins. He was the supervisor on that one. And so he's doing the Doctor Strange sequel, and I'm so psyched just for the visuals, because this is the guy, this is the visual effects supervisor. And by the way, full disclosure, I know him personally. So,
oh, nice.
Yeah, yeah. But he made the best on-screen Hulk in the Avengers. He was responsible to him in ILM.
Wow.
Yeah. Nice. And they really, the Hulk was absolutely at its peak in that, as a character in that movie, as far as the overall look of the Hulk. So there's going to be some exciting visuals in the new Doctor Strange movie. So I interrupted. Anything else you're looking forward to?
Well we got the Knives Out sequel. I think the first one that's coming out this year, I'm looking forward to that. And of course, Michael Keaton coming back as Batman.
Yeah. That's one where I'm going, don't fuck it up. I'm like,
I know.
I'm like going to my my Andy Muschietti altar here in my house. I got candles lit and little pictures of Michael Keaton as Batman. I'm like, please don't fuck this up, because there's lots of opportunity to fuck it up. And I'm on the edge of my seat about that one.
The thought I have is that Keaton did not need to do this.
Yeah.
And so there must have been something that made him say, yeah, this is worth it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That's what intrigues me.
Yeah. Yeah. That's a really good point. And there's obviously a lot of controversy right now, because there was a rumor going around, and this could be entirely debunked, so please chalk this up as a rumor, but that the Flash movie is going to use time travel to, at least in the storyline, erase the events of the Zack Snyder movies. And obviously that has generated all kinds of very friendly and rational debate on social
very
media.
Very reasoned.
I know. But yeah. So I'm looking forward to that one too. So, Zachy, it was great to have you on the show today. I'm so glad to finally get you on. And I definitely want to have you back on a regular basis, not just to talk about movies, but also politics as well. So thanks for coming on, man. I appreciate your time.
Thank you so much, Bob. I appreciate it.
Take it easy. Bye-bye.
Look around. You can find cars like these on AutoTrader. New cars, used cars, electric cars, maybe even flying cars. Okay, no flying cars, but as soon as they get invented, they'll be on AutoTrader. Just you wait. AutoTrader.